May it please the court, counsel for the government, Todd Schultz, assistant federal public defender representing the defendant appellant. At issue in the revocation hearing in this case were three alleged violations, all of which related to the defendant's participation in his sex offender treatment program. The district court abused its discretion in revoking the defendant's supervised release based upon clearly erroneous factual findings that certain photos found in his possession were a violation of his treatment contract. Specifically, there were eight issues that were addressed by the court at the revocation hearing. Seven of those photos were taken by the defendant using his BlackBerry phone. He admitted to taking these photos. And there was one photo that was retrieved from his apartment out of a box. With respect to the BlackBerry photos, these are photos that the defendant took of his young nephew who was helping at a car wash. The car wash was taking place as a fundraiser for a local high school volleyball girls team. The reason the defendant was at this car wash is he drives his mother's car, and his mother asked him if he would come.
Before you get any deeper into the specific facts of the challenged violations, if I could clarify something, there were two admitted violations, is that right?
Yes, Your Honor, there were. He admitted that he had not gainfully found employment, and he also acknowledged that he did not notify his probation officer of law enforcement contact back in November of 2009.
Right, and both of those were revocable offenses or revocable violations?
They certainly were, Your Honor. But with respect to the three disputed allegations, the district court judge did indicate that his ruling on those may have affected his sentence. And so the findings on these are pertinent because it appears from the district court's judgment that it may have imposed a different sentence if, in fact, these three violations had been determined not to be violations. With respect to these...
He's almost finished with this, isn't he?
Your Honor, he is.
He's going to be done with his service of his sentence in less than 30 days.
That's correct, Your Honor. He is. There are some conditions that are disputed as well, but with respect to these particular photos on the BlackBerry, the district judge indicated that it was a violation of the treatment contract to have these photos, but the court did not specifically refer in any way to what provision in the contract was violated. And if one looks at the treatment contract, page 3 lists out sexual materials that the defendant is prohibited from possessing. There are essentially 12 categories of materials. The only category that could conceivably apply to these photos of his nephew would be the fourth paragraph, which addresses any material not generally intended to be erotic, but used by the defendant for the purpose of arousal or other sexual purpose featuring children. The paragraph then goes on to say that these items would be identified by the therapist and the defendant through the therapeutic process. These photos do not fit within that category because there was no evidence before the court that the defendant had used these pictures for any kind of sexual arousal. But perhaps even more convincingly, with respect to the third factor, there was no evidence put before the court that these types of photos, photos of high school girls or photos of his nephew, that these had been identified as materials by his therapist that he could not possess. And so in keeping with the specific language of the contract, it is clear that these photos were not prohibited by the contract. With respect to the one remaining image that was located in his apartment, the evidence with respect to this photo from the probation officer was that when he went over to the defendant's apartment to conduct a home compliance check, he described the defendant's apartment as a mess, said that the defendant was a pack rat, that there were boxes of fast food containers, radio equipment stacked around, and there were several boxes as well. The probation officer testified that it was quite possible, given the state of the apartment, that the defendant had never looked in any of these boxes. There's also no evidence that there was anything in the boxes that would suggest that he looked at them recently. There was nothing in the boxes that postdates the beginning of his supervised release. His father also testified at the hearing, and the district court credited his testimony. He testified that at his own request, he had cleaned out the defendant's bedroom at the family house. He had filled up three boxes, I think essentially of what he would call junk, and called the defendant asking to bring those over to his apartment, essentially to get him out of the house to allow the defendant to go through these boxes at his leisure. One of the boxes, I believe it is important to note, contained materials that the defendant had while he was serving his federal sentence. It is government's number five was one of these items that the defendant had with him while he was serving his sentence within the Bureau of Prisons. He had mailed that and other personal items to his father before entering the halfway house. The court, in ruling that the possession was prohibited by the treatment contract, did not conclude that the defendant's possession of this image was knowing. This overly broad interpretation of the contract, which would not require the possession of this image to be knowing, goes beyond any legitimate objective that could be reasonably related to the defendant's circumstances. This overly broad interpretation should not be permitted. It would be virtually impossible for the defendant to comply with the contract construed as such. The only interpretation of the contract which would make any sense would be for the possession to have to be knowing, because this would then reasonably be related to the idea and concept of preventing recidivism. Even if this court were to find that the possession was knowing, however, it would still not be a violation of the treatment contract. The court, in characterizing the photo, describes the woman as a young girl, which I believe implies that the court thought she was under the age of 18. The U.S. probation officer also said that the woman's age was questionable, although he did not testify that she was under the age of 18. The evidence before the court, though, was that the Secret Service had looked at all photos that were taken from the defendant's apartment that day, and after reviewing all those images, the Secret Service, which are, I believe, the experts in reviewing these types of images, said that none of the images were child pornography and labeled the one image at question, government's exhibit number five, as being female erotica, not child erotica. I believe in so designating it, the Secret Service is very clearly saying that this is not an image of a woman who is under the age of 18.
Did I understand you to say that he had these in his possession while he was incarcerated?
That's correct, Your Honor. The violation conduct summary, which the government supplemented the record with, indicates that the defendant had this image and others while he was within the Bureau of Prisons. And I believe that also suggests that this image is not contraband, despite the probation's concern that it might be. Again, then, relating back to the contract and the section relating to sexual materials, the court doesn't say what provision is specifically violated. And in looking at the 12 categories, this photo, which is female erotica, is not prohibited. And so for the same reasons that the cell phone photos are not prohibited and do not violate the contract, this photo does not as well. I'd reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Schultz. Clark?
Good morning, Your Honors. The defendant in this case admitted, Judge Sykes, as you suggested, that he had violated two conditions, number five and number 11. Number five was that he was supposed to, but did not. He failed to work at a lawful occupation since the beginning of his supervision going back to November of 2008. And he secondly admitted that he failed to notify the probation officer regarding a contact with law enforcement that is through the St. Clair County Sheriff's Office back on November 11th of 2009. It seems to me that these alone are sufficient to justify revocation and a sentence within the guideline range, which was done here.
I don't recall what was the contact with the law enforcement.
It was a routine contact. The local officers contacted the defendant as part of a sex offender registration program. There wasn't any violation of that provision or of the sex offender registration issue. It was just that he didn't report the contact. At any rate, in addition to those two conditions that he admitted to, he also admitted to having contact with a minor, Sarah McBride's daughter, child, and taking her to a daycare center. His treatment contract forbids both frequenting places where children are likely to be present, and it also forbids any contact with a minor. There's an exception in that contract that he signed, and that is for relatives with direct eyesight supervision. I'd note that there is a comma in the contract after the word relatives, and I'd also note that there's a differentiation between relatives, that is, whom he may have contact with, and the word adults, which is who may be supervising. My point is that the exceptions here relate only to contact with the defendant's relatives, and those relatives of the defendant may be supervised by an adult, but with direct eyesight supervision. There's no question, and the defendant admitted that he had had contact with this child. The defendant also, or the judge, found that there was unsupervised contact from the standpoint that the defendant was driving the car, driving his own car with the child in the car, whereas the mother was driving in a different car ahead of him. That was unsupervised contact, which is something that the contract forbids. The court also found that the defendant did not actively participate in his group treatment sessions and also regularly failed to turn in homework assignments as he was required. And as a matter of fact, the appellant acknowledges in his reply brief that he did not turn in homework assignments as required. So, here again, we have another violation of the treatment contract, another violation of his terms of supervised release, which would justify the revocation. On appeal, he tries to connect the group treatment and participation with the photographs that he was talking about. There was more to his failure to participate in group sessions than just the possession of the photographs. As indicated in the transcript, he discusses superficial topics without examining the core issues that brought him to treatment. And he seems to lack motivation to participate meaningfully in group therapy or consistently turning in his homework assignments. And he uses denial, minimization, victim stance, and victim stance to avoid accountability. The court, I should add, noted that these violations individually may not seem all that serious, but when taken in context together, they do put up a red flag that there may be problems here, and that's why the judge revoked the defendant's supervised release. The defendant has talked here in the court about the 37 photos. The restrictions on the photos were that he should not possess the photos. There's no indication here that he did not possess the photos. He knowingly possessed those boxes, and the court found that he essentially constructively possessed those photographs. The restriction is not on whether or not he looked at the photographs, but whether the restriction is against his possession of those photographs. Now, the defendant on appeal makes a strong suggestion that these violated only the fourth condition in the treatment contract, but it's apparent through the testimony that they also violated the first of those bullets, which restricts him from possessing depictions of children engaged in sexual activity, and the eighth provision, which says that he cannot possess material showing sexual activity involving adults. It also says that he cannot, in the third provision there, says that he cannot possess any other visual materials intended for the purpose of causing arousal featuring children in a sexual or erotic manner. Now, what I'm trying to get at here is that the defendant possessed those 37 photos, which according to the violation report, those 37 photos were of girls posing in sexually provocative positions, some barely clothed, and some performing sexual acts on themselves. And it seems to me that those photographs, although they were not the there was only one photograph that was introduced that does not fit the description of the performing sexual acts on themselves, that information was before the court, and therefore it violates the first or the eighth provision of the contract, as well as the third. Consequently, Your Honors, I would ask that the decision of the lower court be affirmed.
Thank you. How much time? I'll give you a couple of minutes.
With respect to the violation that he admitted to failing to report law enforcement contact, the only way that that violation came to his probation officer's attention was that he dutifully noted that in his monthly report. So, but for him dutifully reporting it, albeit not in time, the government would not even have been aware of it. Upon revoking the defendant's supervised release and sentencing him to prison, the court imposed new special conditions, which included location monitoring, curfew, and no contact with minor and other related restrictions. The court erred in imposing these conditions because they're not reasonably related to any legitimate concern arising from the appellant's offense, his history, or characteristics. It was clear that the court believed that the defendant was a danger to the community and that the court needed to protect everyone who had to be around him. Probation shared this sentiment. It appears that both the court and the probation were operating under an unsubstantiated fear that somehow the simple possession offense, possessing child pornography, put Mr. Musso at a higher risk of committing a hands-on sex offense. There was, in fact, no evidence to that effect in front of the court. The defendant's licensed clinical professional counselor had concluded that he was no danger to children. The scholarly studies, which are cited to in the defendant's brief, indicate that there is not this connection between possession and hands-on sex offenses that one might imagine. And for all these reasons, Your Honors, we would respectfully ask that this court vacate the judgment of revocation and release the defendant, or in the alternative, that the court would remand for reconsideration without the contested violations and without the new special conditions.
Thank you. Thanks to both counsel. Case will be taken under advisement.